These guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Now, welcome to Tuesday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand here in the Skyline Studio on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in. Insubordination and improvisation. When do those two meet? We'll talk to Kelly Leonard about that a little bit later in the program. He is the host of the podcast, Getting to Yes and a lot more. Elise Glink, I should say. Amy Guth will be here later. Also, Brad Meltzer, the author. Maybe you've read some of his thrillers. He's got another thriller coming out, I think, in January as a series of children's books out now. They've sold 3 million copies in the past few years. And, of course, a TV History Channel fame as well. We'll check in with Brad just to talk about what's going on in the book industry. We talked to John Najarian about what's going on Wall Street, and he joins us now from CNBC. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Great to be with you, Stephen. Thank you.
It's just so typical now. So the John Bolton is out at the White House, and they can't agree on whether he was fired or resigned. Bolton says he quit. President says he fired him. That aside, when it comes to the markets, I didn't see a big impact on Wall Street, but it did have an impact on oil futures, correct?
It did. We were looking at a pretty serious rally in oil futures for the last month. They've been coming back up, and then they reversed. The president in a tweet, I'm not sure if he corrected himself or anybody else, but he said that he asked for his resignation last night, and then he got it this morning.
Yeah.
So at least in the tweet, it sounds like John Bolton was given the opportunity to walk out rather than be thrown out.
And Bolton's version, and we don't have to get into this, he was texting, I guess, a Fox News anchor, said, "Let's be clear, this was my idea." So, but it doesn't matter. The fact is that the National Security Guard advisor is out. And the theory then is what? That a strike against Iran might be less likely now, so oil might be more plentiful. That's why the futures are down?
Yes, sir. You nailed it. That is the thinking. And we're not talking about massive moves in any case,
right.
But just the initial reaction. You're 100% spot on with that assessment.
Hey, listen, I want to thank you for squeezing me in today. I thought for sure you'd be watching the Big Apple show coming up.
Yeah, well, I am waiting for the multiple camera iPhone because that's one of the things that we've been trained to look for by, like, Boy Genius and Apple Insider, all these websites that have sprung up basically around the Apple ecosystem. They say we're going to see not a 5G phone, because we don't expect that till next year, but we're going to see a phone with multiple cameras and superior cameras. And that makes all the sense in the world, Stephen, because what takes up all the room on your iPhone?
Is it my camera?
It is the pictures.
Oh, it's the pictures, you're right. Oh, no, you're
pictures so right. And videos.
But
and so at $9 a month for the cloud support, if they can get more people onto that, that's like free money for Apple. So if they make the cameras better and people want to play and store the pictures they take and so forth, I've got thousands, I'm sure most of your listeners do too, and you got to pay for storage then.
You know, it's kind of funny, and this doesn't have to do with analyzing stocks, but in many ways, we have so many more pictures. Pictures have become much less meaningful to us because, you know, we're not sort of measuring our lives by the 50 or 100 snapshots that we had, you know, you and I growing up. Now we've got thousands to look at, so no one means that much.
Yeah, true. And yet, like I said, it means a lot of money to Apple. I mean, they've got 1 billion installed users, meaning people that have their iPhones and so forth, 1 billion of those, and a majority of them, I'm sure, by at least the minimum, and some of them by, you know, much more than that, as far as the cloud solution for storing all that data.
So when you're watching this announcement as a stock analyst, what is it that you're looking for? Not what do you hope to see, but as an analyst, what do you watch for to see, well, you know, one way or another how you're going to move?
I think we know most of what's going to be out there. So I think the stock's about where it should be. But if some of the I guess you call them influencers, or some of the real Apple fanboys and girls either really like some new features or really flame those features, that could drive the stock another several percent. But I don't really anticipate that. This stuff gets leaked because of the Chinese factories and so forth. This stuff gets leaked pretty well ahead of these events.
So my dad was a lifelong Ford man, retired now. My kids have Ford stock. It looks like it's a rough day for Ford on Wall Street.
Yeah, I guess Moody's downgraded their debt and the outlook for the company. I still like Ford, but quite frankly, there aren't a lot of automakers in my portfolio. In fact, there are none. So I couldn't think of a good reason. I can buy some support things like O'Reilly Automotive or Advanced Auto Parts, things like that, because I think people are keeping the cars running with those kinds of options. But I'm not a real fan of the car companies, even right now with Mary Barra going in with the president this past week.
All right, so talk to me about Chipotle. New York City is suing them over I think it's a Fair Work Week law that they've got there. That is going to be more and more widespread around the country as more cities implement those laws. But Chipotle suffering again today.
Yeah, and to suffer from something like this is, of course, if you're a shareholder, it hurts no matter what. But this is not like that Ebola.
Well, right.
Ebola.
It's
E. coli. It's not like the E. coli problem that they had before. This is probably a very quick little ding in their stock price, not a long-lasting one like the E. coli was.
Well, exactly. So this is something that they fix. It's not going to keep someone from in Oregon from buying a taco this afternoon, I wouldn't imagine.
Right.
I'm always pulling for Chipotle. All right, what are you watching today?
Believe it or not, there's a luxury goods reseller by the name of The Real Real, and the symbol is REAL. And unfortunately, my wife and daughters are addicted to it.
It's all about everything's resale now, John.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
it truly is. And these guys have some of the best stuff, Stephen, you know, from Louis Vuitton to Jimmy Choo, whatever sort of high-end brands that men and women would be looking for, these guys sell that, and it's not theirs. It's somebody that's cleaning out their closet and pushing it out. These guys take a scalp on that, and they do a fabulous job at it. We saw a lot of institutional buying in that name today.
All right.
So we were buying that stock.
And it sounds like maybe you have an account number there, so maybe you'll share that with me off the air, and I'll go shopping.
I could do that.
All right, John. We'll talk,
off the air.
We'll talk again next week.
Thank you, Stephen.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Steve Bertrand here on this Tuesday afternoon. Thanks very much for tuning in. Kelly Leonard is the host of Getting to Yes And, the podcast that comes from the folks at Second City.
Yeah.
I'm confused about the lineage sometimes of the podcast, but
Well, Second City has a division called Second City Works that brings improvisational skills to corporations and organizations, and that's how this started, is these kinds of conversations around.
All right, and then you find people to talk to, like George Lipsitz, who is a professor of Black Studies Sociology, University of Santa Barbara. The name of his book, Insubordinate Spaces: Improvisation and Accompaniment for Social Justice. Well, that sounds like a page-turner.
It's a little heady. And in fact, when I asked him if he wanted to do the podcast, he's like, I don't think so.
You don't get it.
He didn't think I got it. And he's like, it's not about improv comedy. And I'm like, actually, no, there's a whole field of improvisation that is tied to social justice movements. So we actually ended up having a really cool conversation.
Improvisation, he says, is quintessentially a social activity.
Right.
How does that feed his arguments in his book?
So what he's talking about is, in real times of social justice and change, it has to come from the people. It doesn't come from the people on top are not going to disrupt the order of things.
Right.
So he uses examples of Ferguson, what went on there. And then in Canada, this whole movement around immigrant rights.
I was reading about it, so I'd never heard of the Idle No More movement.
Yeah, I hadn't either. So this took place maybe around 20 years ago or so, and it was looking at indigenous people not being respected, having their land taken away from them, and racism. And so what they did was they sort of had spontaneous dancing and music and pop-up festivals so that other Canadians could see these people as themselves.
How was that improvisation, though, if they're planning to go to Ottawa and dance?
Well, they did. They weren't initially planned. So okay. The whole idea was it was people started getting together themselves. There was no leader. There was no one directing them to go at this place at this time. It sort of happened organically, fueled by social media. Because now with social media, you can, you know, start something in a day. But it wasn't planned ahead of time, and there was no organization guiding it.
You know, before these interviews, you sometimes give me a few quotes, and
yeah.
If I'm lazy, that's all I look at. I've actually tried to read more about this book in this
okay.
case. But another one of these quotes is, in order for social change to take place, it takes place. I don't know what that means.
It takes places. So
it
the
takes places. I'm
yeah, the idea is that you do need an actual place in which to form your ideas and collaborate with other people. And one of the really compelling examples they use was Archbishop Romero. And I found an interesting tie to our improv, and George bought it. Keith Johnstone, who's a legendary improv instructor, talks about improvisation as walking backwards into the future.
Okay.
So the idea there is that you can't see what's in the future, but what you're working with is both what's behind you and what you've learned, but also who's next to you.
Right.
Romero talks about walking down a road with the peasants and the fact that the church got away from really caring for the people it was supposed to care for. And if we're walking down a road with them, we're all equal. Sometimes we're, you know, ahead, sometimes we're behind. But what's really important is our peripheral vision. And this actually comes up a lot in the interviews I do with futurists and business people, is that our ability to have peripheral vision is what will help us guide ourselves in the future.
So I guess to put a point on that,
yeah.
then, this is a business show. What is it that business leaders or executives take from this conversation?
Yeah, what they need to know is, like, it's wisdom of the crowds, right? We misunderstand sometimes what that means. And if we want to understand what the people we're selling to or the people we want buying our products, we have to talk to them and we have to see them and understand their needs as opposed to putting our needs on them.
But the crowds aren't always right.
No, but the crowds don't often know what they want. Like, you wouldn't go to a
improvisation happens, it takes places.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, think about the iPhone. You wouldn't say to someone, hey, are you going to want this device in your hand, this computer in your
right.
hand? They wouldn't have known that. However, if you look at the problems people have and what issues they're dealing with, you can design solutions.
Kelly Leonard is the host of the podcast Getting to Yes, and this one drops later this afternoon, or is it already available?
Just available.
All right, so. WGNradio.com. Thanks for coming by, Kelly.
Thanks, man.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Okay, whenever I need to check in on the book industry, used to have my fingers on the pulse a little bit more than I do now, but when I need to check in on what's going on in publishing, I talk to my old friend Brad Meltzer, the author, who is on the phone line now. Brad, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Always good to be here, my friend.
We have been talking now for what, about 60 years?
I mean, I feel like it. I think when I met you, I had a full head of hair, so that should pretty much say it.
I didn't want to bring that up, but I think that's exactly right. Okay, so when we met, you were writing these thrillers, and I see you just signed another 3-book deal. We'll get to that. But about, 5 or 6 years ago, you moved into this Ordinary People Change the World series, a kid's series of books about people who grew into becoming renowned, but you sort of tell their story as children, right? And you've got 18 and 19 coming out this fall?
Yeah, you know, I just wanted my kids to have better heroes to look up to, because what our kids see every day is fame. And what we got to teach our kids more about is character. Character's been lost in America. And so we use real American heroes to bring it back. We've done I'm Amelia Earhart, I'm Abraham Lincoln, I am George Washington, and now we do the most requested. Talk about listening to your audience when you run your business. The number one requested hero we've gotten in the whole series is I Am Walt Disney, which
really?
Is the new one.
And so 3 million sold, right?
It's three. Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy number when you look at it.
It is a crazy number.
And I'll tell you what happened. And it's a really interesting marketing story, which is when the election in 2016, the presidential election was happening, two of our books started selling more than any others. And they were I Am Martin Luther King Jr. and I am George Washington. And it wasn't a Democrat or Republican thing. It was people were looking at Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump beat each other's heads open every day on the TV. And what they really wanted was to stop showing their kids politicians. They wanted to show their kids leaders. We know there's a huge difference between politicians and leaders. And for the in the time since the election, we've watched our series grow at a time when publishing is, of course, shrinking. And it's that people are using our books to fight back and teach kids about humility with Neil Armstrong, teach kids about, you know, what it means to look out for others with I Am Abraham Lincoln, show their kids what real leadership looks like. And that's been something about, you know, for our business, that's really been in the right place at the right time, so, something we could never possibly control.
Well, that's an interesting point then. So you're not really exploiting the division that we're in right now. You're in a way salving it. You have a salve for it that was already up and running.
Yeah, we were doing this at, you know, for 4 years at this point when it happened, and we just started watching our old books taking off. And the crazy part for us is I love the fact that people are using our books to build real libraries for their sons, their daughters, their nieces, their nephews, their grandkids.
Right.
That's, you know, they're building a library of real heroes for them, and they're using our books to fight back over this, exactly what you said, not just the division in our society, but the cynicism and the fame that we worship and the athletes that we overpay. You know, my son loves sports. I said, you want to see what a real athlete hero looks like? Here's I Am Jackie Robinson, which I wrote for him. It's one of our top-selling books. It's a six-year-old book. But, you know, I know one thing. If I've learned anything about business all these years, as I learned one thing, Steve, I'm not that special. And if I want these things for my kids, there are people who want those for theirs. And so I used I Am Walt Disney to teach, you know, my son, who's an entrepreneur, what it means to build a business in the way that Walt Disney does. Well, it's an incredible lesson.
I hadn't really thought of it that way, but your audience keeps growing into your books in a way. I mean, it's not like you're writing The Tenth Justice where people are going to read it and then put it aside. There are going to be new kids born, or there are going to be new grandparents made, and they're going to be wanting to buy these books for their new grandchildren. So, I mean, it's sort of, Brad, I think you finally found the idea that's going to last forever.
I wish we could be so lucky. I mean, I think you can't plan on what the audience is going to do. All I know is that there's a real need for heroes today. We're starving for heroes as a culture. And, you know, when I took someone like Walt Disney, I can tell the story. You know, we all know Walt Disney's story, right?
Right.
We know he's, you know, built Disney and it looked at this great American success story. But the story that's most important in there is one of his first businesses, it completely and utterly fails. It goes so bad that he has to declare bankruptcy, they tell him, and he's 21 years old. He's so poor, he has to sleep in his office and take baths once a week at the train station. And I want my kids to know that you don't get Disneyland and Disney World and Mickey Mouse. It's not just magic. That's not magic. It's hard work. That's what Walt Disney stands for. When he makes a mouse, he says, I got an idea for a new mouse. And he tells his wife that we're going to call it Mortimer Mouse. And she says, that's a terrible name.
Right, right.
That's literally what she says. That's a terrible name. She says, what about Mickey? And he's like, I like that. And that's how Mickey Mouse comes. Again, it's not magic. It's hard work. It's failing and then failing and failing again and then succeeding.
I'm glad.
We need our kids to learn that lesson.
I'm glad after 18 books you finally wrote about a businessman, because I've been starving here for that.
Yeah, listen, I think a lot of kids request it because they just like Mickey Mouse, but there are parents who, you know, were requesting it because they're like, this is someone that I look up to for what he built. And the amazing part is, as on the business side, again, Walt Disney was research. You know, he used to take his daughters to the merry-go-round and he'd say, this is boring for adults. It's great for kids, but there's nothing for the parents to do. So he starts researching all the different amusement parks around the country, the most popular ones. He looks at Gettysburg even, and he says, we're going to make a new park. And it's going to be filled with yesterday and tomorrow and even a land for fantasy. And they said, well, what about today? Is it going to be stuff from today? And he says, no, nothing from today is going to be there. Just the past, the future, and fantasy land. And he makes Disneyland. And I, again, love the fact that it's done with research. It's done with time. It's, you know, it's done with hard work. And if we want our kids to get those lessons, you can't just tell them, you got to show them. And Walt Disney, you know, when we did I Am Walt Disney, it just gave us a great opportunity to show that story over and over again.
Here we are in September, and I know in November, a couple months from now, then there will be a PBS series based on this, too. You've had great success in TV, whether it was you know, the history shows, or with Jack and Bobby back in the day.
Yeah, when we did, and listen, Decoded and Lost History on the History Channel, you know, really was the most amazing experience for us. That's where most people know me from. But oddly, the next time we go back to TV, as you said, is we're going for kids. We're going to PBS. They're going to build a series around the Ordinary People Change the World books that we've done. And it's called Xavier Riddle and the Secret Museum. It's a story.
I'm sorry.
One of the stars is actually named Brad.
I was going there.
Cartoon character you'll ever see.
That's why I'm trying to interrupt you, because I see there's a kid named Brad in the show. Who drew him, and did you have approval?
You know what? Chris Eliopoulos, our amazing artist who does the book series, obviously he drew me as a character, and it's a great character to have. What happens on the series is Xavier and Brad and their sister, Yadina, they have a problem like being bullied. They have a secret museum that takes them back in time. They meet Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks teaches them how to deal with bullies, and they come back to the present day and figure out how to deal with the bully. And every episode is a different hero, like the I Am series. But the amazing part to me, Steve, is we are launching on November 11th. It'll be 50 years and one day after Sesame Street premiered on PBS.
Wow.
Xavier Riddle will premiere. And so no pressure at all there.
No. Okay, let's zoom out a little bit, 30,000 feet. You mentioned that the publishing world is shrinking. I mean, give me a quick answer. How is the book biz?
You know, it depends what you're writing. I write thrillers, and they do fine because thrillers are popular. If you write popular thrillers, but the kind of small book that used to kind of go down the middle is just getting beaten down every day. If you write comic books or graphic novels, those do well. And our nonfiction books, we found great growth in, because we did a book about, you and I spoke about, the secret plot to kill George Washington,
right,
called The First Conspiracy, and that book. We launched a brand new, it was a brand new vein for us. It was nonfiction for adults. Did really well. There's an appetite for that, and certain kids' books. But the truth is, they're just with less bookstores. And what's happening is the biggest authors do well, but it's really hard to break in a new book. You can have the big monster, superstar book like Educated or something big that comes along, but that smaller book that used to just sell well and people used to read. That's just a harder part of the business, because people can't browse anymore. You just don't have the time to go. You know, that Borders that was down in Chicago downtown, you'd walk in at lunch, you'd look at 100 books on the table, you'd pick one. Now, if you go on Amazon or you go into an independent store, those tables are just smaller. The browsing is smaller, so you're just picking from five.
And it's a funny thing, because, the phrase is you can't judge a book by its cover, but that's exactly how we choose books many ways, browsing, looking at covers like that. Check out... The latest in the series, Walt Disney and Marie Curie. We didn't mention Marie at all, but the Ordinary People Change the World series from Brad Meltzer. Brad Meltzer changes the world just about every day, and I'm glad you joined us today. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, we'll talk soon. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Calling all Skokians, Skokieites. Skokie people? Anyway, hey Skokie, you guys are getting an Amazon shipping warehouse. Yeah, a 230,000 square foot delivery warehouse will be coming and hiring hundreds of part-time workers to help our country's addiction of seeing a random product online, liking it, buying it blindly, and questioning it later. Why did I buy 4 packages of pickle popsicles? I'm allergic to pickles. Amazon also announced that they're planning on hiring thousands of jobs around the country later next week in Chicago, Boston, Dallas, Nashville, and Seattle. They're calling it their Amazon Career Day. So just look it up if you're looking for a job. And the next time you look up at Soldier Field, professional soccer team the Chicago Fire might be calling it home. Discussions will begin this week between the Park District and the team to move them from their current home in Bridgeview, Old Toyota Park, now known as SeatGeek Stadium. The team wants out of the spot they're in right now, and I don't blame them. Who wouldn't want to play in Soldier Field? That would be sweet. I'm Bennett Wakeknight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Ed Wehmer, the boss of Wintrust is going to be on the program a little bit later this week. He'll come by on Friday afternoon. Speaking of bosses, Amy Guth is in the studio, and she is the boss of the Daily Gist. The
nice. I like how you did that.
Podcast from Crane Chicago Business and WGNRadio.com as well. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, so, well, I was going to say the president's in the news, which is silly because he's the president.
That's every hour on the hour.
But every president's always in the news. But he is today with this John Bolton change. And then earlier this morning, I heard the story that J.P. Morgan, and this is interesting to me, but you're going to have to explain it to me. But they're creating an index to measure the impact of his tweets.
That's exactly what they have done. They're not the only ones either. So Bank of America, Merrill Lynch has also been tracking the impact of his tweets. The JP Morgan one is very interesting because they're looking at about 5 minutes after each tweet, what happens to the market, particularly if the tweet includes the words China, billion, products, Democrats, or great, it is most likely to affect prices.
So they've already been measuring things.
That's right.
You know, and this goes back to his first days in office. I remember because, you know, other presidents, a lot of what this president does, no other president has ever done. Very early on, when he took on Boeing, remember that he came out about the cost of the new Air Force One, and we just watched the Boeing stock tank. Thinking this doesn't happen.
I know, and it's really fascinating. I mean, we talk about like, oh, haha, the president's tweeting again. But here's some hard data saying, well, sometimes this does have an impact on what we're looking at with Treasury yields.
Okay, so but this comes with a bit of a jab too, right? What are they calling this index?
Well, if you recall, there was the very mysterious tweet. I think he fell asleep holding his phone. I don't know what happened, but he one night tweeted "Covfefe," and everybody was saying that and making jokes and parody videos. So they're calling it the Volfefe index, like volatility plus Covfefe.
Ah, I get it. Okay. Yeah. So when you get this information or this data, what do you do with it?
Well, that's the thing. So, I mean, in theory, JP Morgan could give it to the White House and be like, you know, Mr. President, when you get angry and tweet about things, you are maybe don't do that. Ah, we'll see if he would care about that.
We're assuming things only go down. I mean, do others go up sometimes?
Not usually.
No.
The only time, especially in the Bank of America Merrill Lynch study, they noticed that the only time there's an impact for the better is the days he tweets less, when he tweets less than five times.
Do we keep track of what makes him tweet more often than not?
I wish I knew. I wish anybody knew.
Because he was in a lull, right? I think right before the election.
Right before the inauguration. He was at his low, about five a day, but he's averaging about 10 tweets a day since the start of 2016. So he's done 10,000 tweets occurring after his inauguration. It reached a low of five tweets per day heading into those days leading into inauguration because, you know, you'd be stressed out about that.
You got things to do.
Which
presumably you still do. But
you got to move. You got to settle in. Got to figure out what you're going to wear.
Volfefe index.
And, I think it's funny.
That's what I'm asking. Is this something that's just funny? Or I don't quite get what we get out of it.
Well, I don't think it's for us. I think it's to make a bigger statement to political figures.
It's a serious thing.
Saying, look, hey, it's not a giant impact per se each time, but we are seeing that it's not just a dude with a Twitter account. You are the president of the United States, and there is some responsibility to the markets and the language you're using, and I think that's really what they're aiming at here.
I mean, Boeing certainly recovered from those early tweets. They had a great year on the Dow, but the fact is that if you were holding that stock and selling it that day, you were a big loser.
That's right. I mean, big loser's kind of mean, but, you know, you didn't win that day.
Well, I mean, if you sold it,
that's right.
You're a big loser when it comes. All right, what else is on the Daily Gist today?
Well, we're actually also talking a little bit about Boeing. So I looked at how the Southwest CEO says, hey, when we figure out how to recoup our losses from Boeing, I'm going to share that with
our workers.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I also talked with Dalton Barker, who's a reporter at Crane's, about the distillery business. A law has changed.
That's a great story.
I think it's so interesting. So essentially, distillers can serve double what they could now, and they can serve beer and wine and stuff like that. So it might be putting your corner bar.
So like a local distillery can bring people in, sell it, just like a brewery can now.
Exactly right.
All right, we'll watch that. The Daily Gist coming up this afternoon. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks so much.